Hi, you're listening to an audio documentary series brought to you by the independent think tank Respublica, narrated by Jack Aldane. This is Dust to Dust. Dust to Dust has been released as part of Airtight on Asbestos, a nationwide campaign by Respublica to urge the UK government to reform its safety monitoring standards around asbestos in public buildings. In part three, we speak to several victims of the fatal illnesses caused by asbestos and examine the health and safety executive's approach to management of the material to uncover the questions it leaves dangerously unanswered. When Respublica began its campaign in the summer of 2019, the UK was fast approaching the 20th anniversary of a ban that finally ended its long and lethal dependence on asbestos. This was an opportune moment to rediscover the role this material had played in building Britain's industrial legacy and uncover the large body of evidence that showed the extent to which asbestos still poses a major public health risk in the UK. Despite the ban, the country has the highest mortality rate from asbestos-related disease in the world. On parts 1 and 2 of Dust to Dust, we gave several facts that most vividly illustrate the contemporary dangers around asbestos. In particular, we pointed to the fact that an overwhelming majority of British schools and NHS trusts contain the material, much of it highly toxic. This alone means that today, public sector workers such as nurses and teachers are 3 to 5 times more likely than average to develop the fatal lung disease, mesothelioma. Also at increased risk of developing this illness are school children, who spend a large portion of their early lives in high-risk buildings. The figures tell an unsettling story. Since the ban in 1999, we've seen a steady rise in the number of asbestos-related deaths, specifically among school teachers. Since 1980, around 291 school teachers have died, 177 since 2001. Given this, why then hasn't more been done to tackle this ongoing workplace hazard? This part of the series is titled Dangerous Unknowns, because as we shall learn, it is the small amount we do know about the risks posed by asbestos in Britain's public estate that makes what we don't know all the more worrying. Asbestos is a largely forgotten problem, but it is nonetheless a problem in our time. What makes it easy to ignore is that the vast majority of it exists in situ. That is to say, behind walls and ceiling tiles, under floorboards and within attic spaces, out of sight and so out of mind. In its report, titled Don't Breathe In, Bridging the Asbestos Safety Gap, Respublica makes the case for reform to the Health and Safety Executive's management regime around asbestos. Current UK regulation stipulates that unless asbestos is visibly disturbed, it is, quote, safe to assume that it poses no harm and is being well managed. The HSE meanwhile predicts that the rate at which deaths from exposure to asbestos occur will decline sharply after 2020, as sufferers formerly employed in traditional high-risk occupations decrease over time. But as we shall discover throughout the remainder of the series, the HSE's projections for tomorrow are tethered to the realities of yesterday, not today. While it is true that deaths linked to traditional occupations are falling and will continue to fall, the rise in the number of workplace deaths in non-traditional occupations already mentioned shows there is a new tranche of avoidable deaths and that the HSE appears to have no plan to stop them. We'll be hearing shortly from the victims of this regulatory oversight, from sufferers of mesothelioma and their loved ones, all of whose stories represent the professions most at risk today. Respublica has also contacted several mesothelioma sufferers under the age of 40 who suspect their illnesses began in school. However, many of these stories could not be told here on Dust to Dust, because much of the detail remains confidential while legal proceedings are underway. I spoke to Sandra Kellett, who was diagnosed with mesothelioma in 2019. Kellett was told she had 6 months to live. Now 62 years old, she has spent her life caring for the sick as an NHS nurse. Her career began in the mid-70s as a 19-year-old trainee at Billinge Hospital, a former Victorian workhouse in Wigan that was built using asbestos for insulation throughout. Sandra explained that her training at Billinge gave her some insight into the seriousness of her condition years later, but that her diagnosis was slow to come to light.
I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 2015. After the 6 rounds of chemo for the lymphoma, I was put on maintenance rituximab, which is one of the chemo agents. Unfortunately, I developed a severe allergy to it. I was really poorly at the time. My lung function had gone down to 45%, and I went on steroids then for 12 months and picked up on the steroids. But then as I finished the steroids, I started to get breathless again and was coughing again. And I just presumed it was because I'd perhaps stopped the steroids too soon and needed to go back on them. But I saw the chest consultant, and she took one look at me and realised I was quite breathless, sent me for a chest x-ray and told me to go straight back in to see her after the x-ray. And when I went back in, she told me it was showing fluid in my right lower lobe, and she wanted me to have an urgent CT scan, which I went for. I had all this done within 2 weeks. I went for the CT scan and went back to see her, and she gave me options: a needle biopsy and antibiotics, or a VATS procedure, which was biopsies. And I went for the biopsies, and then I went back to see her for the results. And she was just not being straight with me when I first went in to see her. She was just asking how I was and, you know, offering pleasantries. And I just said to her, I said, have you not got my results? Because that's what I've come for. And she just looked at me and she said, and can I just say, I am so, so shocked by this diagnosis. I never in a million years would I have suspected this. And I thought to myself then, God, this doesn't sound good. And she turned around and she said, it's mesothelioma.
Sandra said she knew immediately what this meant for her.
I'd worked on a cancer unit and nursed patients with mesothelioma. And I remember looking at my husband and saying to him, mesothelioma, it's the worst diagnosis they could have given me. I believe now that I contracted the mesothelioma whilst working at Billinge Hospital during my initial training, because I've always worked in NHS and there was just no other areas where I could have been exposed to asbestos. We never lived in any houses with asbestos. My dad didn't work with asbestos. My mum didn't.
I also spoke to John Blunt, a retiree who currently lives in Balsall Common in Solihull. His wife, Janet Blunt, passed away from mesothelioma at the age of 58 in 2014. John told me the story of her diagnosis, which she received 1 month after their 25th wedding anniversary.
We went away for a nice holiday. During the holiday period, my wife had become very breathless. So we just thought it was just possibly a cold or something. Went back to work. She got to the Friday of the first week at work and collapsed in my arms when she got home. So I had the usual panics. She wouldn't allow me to call 999, so I called 111. We went into hospital. We then spent probably 4 weeks being passed from pillar to post, having various tests that all came back negative. She then came home, but just before she came home, we had a chest surgeon come over from the QA who actually gave us the first proper diagnosis, and he actually said, I think you've got a meso. The PAC test actually came back and actually said she'd got a large mesothelioma cancer in her lung. Subsequently, she passed away 2 months later.
Janet had also spent her life in healthcare, working as a GP at the Heartlands Hospital Trust in Birmingham between 1984 and 1988. As John explained, the hospital underwent refurbishments, during which time Janet was regularly on call. The refurbishment works involved the removal of ceiling and wall panels, which readily caused disturbance to the asbestos in the building. The only precaution taken at the time to stop asbestos fibres from becoming airborne was a thin layer of plastic sheeting laid over the exposed areas. Then came the great storm of 1987.
The buildings people would just set up barriers and things, and they would expect you to walk the correct side. Unfortunately, in this case, because it was down the main corridor, they didn't even give us any indication other than when they were working over which side of the barriers to walk. There was a fairly violent storm and the plastic sheeting all blew down. As they had already exposed most of the ceiling tiles and things, the works that I subsequently found out that they were doing were removing asbestos ceiling tiles. The hospital basically carried on as normal. My wife was actually on duty during this period of time. Life carried on.
The cause of Janet's illness years later lay beyond any doubt. Yet in truth, both Sandra and Janet's cases reflect a time in which such conditions would have been perceived as minor hazards. Sandra and Janet's stories reveal just how poor standards of removal of asbestos were before the ban. Many public sector workers like them would only learn of the impact this had decades later. Blue and brown asbestos were phased out of British industry by 1985, shortly after which a more robust approach was taken to removing the material from public infrastructure. Today, asbestos removal involves first sealing and isolating an area under negative pressure to minimize the movement of dust particles. Throughout the process, removal specialists are required to wear head-to-toe protective clothing fitted with breathing apparatus. Removal sites are cordoned off and marked as hazardous to warn passers-by that the material is present. After a removal is complete, the cordons and shelter are dismantled slowly to reduce any residual disturbance. It would be wrong, however, to think that because removal practices have vastly improved over the last 40 years, that cases such as that of Janet Blunt and Sandra Kellett are an historical anomaly. Asbestos poses a threat today not because of the methods that are used to remove it, but because of the methods that aren't used to manage it in situ. A worrying proportion of public sector workers do not know where in their places of work the material lurks, and often have little or no idea about whether it has ever been disturbed. Crucially, as we shall come back to shortly, the UK does not enforce sensitive air monitoring to establish whether teachers, nurses and schoolchildren are breathing air contaminated with deadly asbestos on a daily basis. If a teacher who works at a school they know to contain asbestos happens to see a cavity in the wall of a corridor, say, they may report this to what the HSE calls the duty holder of the premises. If the duty holder decides it is the right course of action, removal of the uncovered asbestos may be authorised. If the asbestos appears only slightly disturbed, however, it may be painted over without being removed. In February of this year, news of the death of a highly regarded British doctor by the name of Mags Portman was released on Scottish news website The Daily Record. Dr. Portman died from mesothelioma in 2019 at the age of 44 after being exposed to asbestos at Law Hospital in Lanarkshire. She was diagnosed in 2017, 8 years after the building was demolished. The building turned out to contain around 1,500 tons of asbestos. Labour Health spokeswoman Monica Lennon commented that Dr. Portman's death demonstrated that it is no longer enough for UK authorities to issue the public its usual assurance that, quote, asbestos is safe unless it is disturbed. She added that there remains outstanding around £1 billion in maintenance works across hundreds of Scottish hospitals, which explains why someone like Dr. Portman could have been allowed to work for 5 whole years in such dangerous conditions. John Peterson, the NHS Lanarkshire Director of Property and Support Services, responded with the very boilerplate statement Lennon had disparaged, that asbestos is generally not unsafe if it is intact and not disturbed. Peterson's response conveniently ignores the fact that for the 5 years in which Dr. Portman worked at Law Hospital, her workplace would have been deemed safe, according to these very guidelines. So, what exactly are the provisions of the HSE's compliance guidelines for effective management of asbestos? If you go to Part 5 of the HSE's online management guidelines, under the heading Inspect Your Building, you'll see a list of step-by-step instructions. They are as follows. 1. Copy or draw a plan of the building. 2. walk around, and look. 3. Get some help. A second pair of eyes is always useful. 4. Mark on the plan what contains or might contain asbestos. 5. Print a blank asbestos register. 6. Note down each material that might contain asbestos. Note how much there is and its condition, in brackets, good/poor. 7. Where you can't get access, for example a roof void or wall cavity, presume that this contains asbestos. Note this down in the register. 8. When your inspection is finished, complete your asbestos register. 9. Add the date and sign it. Once an asbestos register has been completed, the HSC advises duty holders to take appropriate action where needed. If asbestos is found during an inspection and looks to be damaged and therefore presents a hazard, then the duty holder should transfer this information to another register, known as a material and priority scoring tool. This form measures other variables such as normal occupant activity, likelihood of disturbance, and human exposure potential on a score of 1 to 3. The HSC instructs duty holders to add the normal occupant activity score to the 3 average scores from the likelihood of disturbance, human exposure potential, and maintenance activity sections to get a total priority score. The total priority score is then added to the material score, which gives a total overall score. The total overall score tells the duty holder whether it is necessary to call in a contractor to take urgent maintenance or removal works. Numerous surveys and Freedom of Information (FOI) requests demonstrate that many duty holders cannot sufficiently account for the type and condition of asbestos in their premises, even with such protocols in place. An FOI request undertaken for S Publica's report revealed that less than 50% of local education authorities in the UK were able to provide the names of schools within their control by type of asbestos located within them. In addition, the HSC does not hold a central register or database that shows where asbestos can be found in public buildings across the country and in what condition. So, while some duty holders busy themselves with compliance forms based on what their senses tell them about the material that kills slowly and invisibly, the HSC sees very little of the resulting data. Employees may be told if an inspection is underway, if high-risk materials have been discovered, or if asbestos works are planned, but that is only if a duty holder believes what they have seen to merit further action in the first instance. Nothing the duty holder currently does can say one way or another whether the air people breathe every day inside a building may in fact be sending them to an early grave. In its report, Respublica suggests there is a way to make such dangerous unknowns knowable. At the core of the Airtight on Asbestos campaign is the demand for government to make the use of highly sensitive air monitoring technology a legal requirement in public buildings nationwide. Instead of basing the duty to manage asbestos on human observation, it argues that effective management should use the best practices to estimate how much asbestos dust a nurse, teacher, or schoolchild breathes on any given day, and use this data to assess each case for removal, taking into account whether the asbestos in question is of high toxicity. As things stand, the HSC says that the only condition under which a duty holder should test for asbestos is, quote, if they are already planning works to a building. Sensitive air monitoring methods are currently used for this purpose in buildings in countries such as Germany, France, and the Netherlands. It is not clear why such methods are not applied in the UK, especially as we already know the overwhelming proportion of public buildings that contain asbestos and the suffering this has already caused. Frances Perraudin, a reporter at The Guardian who covered the findings in Respublica's report back in November 2019, explained to me what alerted her to asbestos in schools. She went on to scoop the front page of the newspaper in July that year, under the headline, 700 English Schools Reported Over Asbestos Safety Concerns.
I thought the strongest story I was going to produce from this work was going to be just the fact that we are living through this kind of crisis of asbestos deaths, and that there are 5,000 asbestos-caused deaths every year, and the Health and Safety Executive is saying that is reaching a peak. But in the end, the story that got the most prominence was this snapshot of the situation in schools, which came from this asbestos campaigner, Lucy Stevens.
Lucy Stevens works as head of co-production at the New Economics Foundation. She began campaigning to raise awareness around asbestos in schools in 2016, 2 years after her mother, Sue Stevens, was diagnosed with mesothelioma. Sue Stevens had been a primary school teacher in Buckinghamshire for 30 years before being diagnosed. Her case was featured in an article by The Mirror in May of last year, after it was found that more than 200 teachers had died from exposure to asbestos since 2009.
She did this Freedom of Information request to the Department for Education, which found that 700 schools in England had been reported to the Health and Safety Executive over concerns that they weren't properly looking after the asbestos in their schools.
Peraudin told me she expected the victims and campaigners she spoke to for the story to express anger about the past, but that most were angry about the lives placed in jeopardy today because of the persistent negligence of the current management regime.
All of these campaigners I was talking to, people who are suffering from mesothelioma, actually the area that their anger lay in was that there's still asbestos all around us, and that's what they were focusing on. So it took me a while to kind of realise that I needed to shift focus, and maybe the story that should be given the most attention was a story that made that point, that there's still asbestos in public buildings, which isn't being managed.
She explained finally how the HSE responded when asked to comment on the underlying problem that had led the Department of Education to issue so many referrals.
They still argue that they are actively working to make sure that buildings are safe and that asbestos is not disturbed and that it's all being well managed. I think they were quite upset with the story because they thought the story made it sound like they were passive bystanders to the situation, whereas they wanted it to seem like they were doing things to make sure that people weren't being exposed to asbestos in schools. And they still argue that it's safer to leave it where it is and manage it in situ.
The teacher I spoke to will be referred to on this episode simply as Jerry. Jerry is a scientist by training and a retired science teacher who believes she developed mesothelioma after being exposed to asbestos fibres in a laboratory. Jerry said she was later exposed again during her teaching career. The proximity in which she was expected to work to asbestos at one school is almost reminiscent of the industrial textile mills described earlier in this series.
The first school which I went to teach in was one of the schools which had been put together from taking an old either grammar school or technical school, building on very quickly another part of the school when they raised the school leaving age up to 16, where there was a need for more space. A lot of those buildings, there was a lot of asbestos in them. All the pipes, for example, would have been lagged with asbestos fibres of some type. But one thing that particularly I remember is that all the ceiling tiles were also had the content of asbestos in them. And they were always loose. The kids used to love coming in and seeing who could jump high enough to push one of them up into the ceiling. And then the caretaker would come round, get his ladder out and put them back again. The second school that I worked in on a long-term basis was an older school, but it still had asbestos in it. My actual desk in the prep room was painted over asbestos. They say that is safe. Now, I'm aware that the monitoring of the amount of asbestos in schools is, I think, A, it's very crudely done. It isn't done very often, and I am aware that there are people with a lot more expertise than I have myself who think that, you know, the tolerance limits for students in schools, what the government are saying, are far too high. Far too high.
Jerry touches on a point here that we will come back to in part four. That is, the limits of exposure to asbestos that the HSE deems acceptable. The HSC currently sets that limit at, quote, less than 0.01 fibres per cubed centimetre, though adds that this should be taken, quote, only as a transient indication of site cleanliness and is not an acceptable permanent level. In other words, its limit remains unfixed and ill-defined and so does not allow us to know whether the air breathed in public buildings is safe or is not. In Germany, the acceptable level of airborne asbestos in schools and other public buildings is 0.001 fibres per cubed centimetre, 10 times lower than that of the UK. This is largely because the methods of monitoring used in Germany give 10 times more accurate readings of airborne levels of asbestos than do those used in the UK. The upshot here is that under the current regime, school children in the UK could be exposed to 10 times the amount of asbestos that is accepted in Germany. The health implications of this are huge. Professor Julian Peto, a cancer epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who we heard from on part two, says the evidence shows there is a clear link between severity of exposure and the development of cancer later in life.
All carcinogens produce cancer more or less in proportion to how heavily you're exposed. And we've got every reason to believe, and the data support it, that if you're exposed to twice as much asbestos, you'll have more or less twice the risk.
A study from the US goes even further in illustrating the unique risks children face by pointing out that for every teacher who dies from mesothelioma because of exposure to asbestos in a school building, 9 children can be expected to die from the same cause during the course of their lives. All this we shall return to in the fourth and final part of the series, where we'll hear more from the victims and learn from a range of industry experts about what can be done to stop the domino effect that is shortening the lives of one generation of teachers, nurses, and schoolchildren after another. It is worth pausing here for a moment to consider one cause of the current inaction. For the year 2009 to 2010, the HSC received £231 million from the UK government. For the year 2019 to 2020, it received £128 million, a reduction of 45% over 10 years. Respublica invited one of the HSC staff to appear on Dust to Dust. The HSC declined, saying that agreeing to appear would be, quote, inappropriate, as it could be seen to compromise the HSC's independence both in industry and government. We turn then finally to Lucy Stevens, whose campaign to remove asbestos from all schools in the UK uses the website www.toxicschools.org.uk, allowing parents to see whether their child's school contains asbestos. Provided that a school has participated in the government survey, known as the Asbestos Management Assurance Process, otherwise known as AMAP, any parent wishing to know what the duty holder knows should be able to find out. In theory. Much like Airtight on Asbestos, Stevens's campaign demands that the UK government prioritise the removal of asbestos from schools, starting with buildings that pose the highest risk. The challenge her campaign faces recalls precisely the problem we described earlier, the fact that the HSC does not keep a central database on the location and condition of asbestos. But as well as this, Stevens says that demanding any information from authorities about this issue so often leads to systematic stonewalling.
So part of the campaign that I've been running is asking for the phased removal of asbestos from all schools, starting with the most dangerous schools first, but working to a long-term aim to remove asbestos from all schools by 2028. It's critical that that starts with those most dangerous schools first, but without that kind of longer-term plan and targets for year-on-year removal and earmarked funding to enable that work to take place, what continues to happen is a really unclear kind of picture that if a school manages to strike it lucky and win funding for school repairs or improvement, then they might be able to build asbestos removal into that programme, but there's no earmarked funds for asbestos. There's no fast track. If you're a school with a critical asbestos problem, you're still competing against every other school with leaking roofs and flooded hallways and everything else. So there needs to be that very kind of strategic national level plan. But until we have kind of access to the data, we won't know exactly where the problems are. And without pressure from parents and school staff, it will be very difficult to hold government to account in that way. So releasing this data is really important. I've taken my request now to the Information Commissioner and have a case with them, and they're investigating whether the Department for Education was right to withhold the data.
Join us for the fourth and final part of Dust to Dust, where we find out whether Stevens' attempts to answer these unknowns succeeded, and what industry experts say can and must be done to deliver on the ban's true aim, which can be nothing short of ending this silent killer's stranglehold on life in the UK for good.